Blog Talk Radio.
About y'all, and you know that's what I'm talking about. I'm giving it to you straight with no chaser every single week on Everybody Is a Star. Okay, this is CHOCLET, and you are tuned in to Everybody Is a Star live on Tribe Family Channel. As a matter of fact, check this out, when I say straight, you say funk. Y'all ready? Straight
funk.
Hey. That's what I'm talking about. Thank you for joining us tonight. Hope your week was powerful and positive. And now you can relax and get ready to get this party started. We are going to roll. Y'all know how we do every week. Y'all know how we do. And once again, this week, we have a funkmeister in the house. Known for his extraordinary musicianship, the ability to reinvent, adapt, and remain relevant in this music game for over 35 years is no small feat. He is all things jazz, R&B, hip-hop, gospel, and funk, okay? That's a mouthful right there. So, without further ado, let's welcome Mr. Wayne Cobham. Wayne, what's up, my brother?
What's
How
up,
you doing? Peace.
What's up, everybody? How y'all doing?
We are doing good. Listen, I know you are a truly, truly busy brother, and I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, the pleasure's really mine. It's mine.
Good.
You know, you're one of my favorite heroes. You know you're one of my heroes.
No, I didn't know that, but you're making me blush, and it's hard to make chocolate blush, okay? I'm over here blushing. Thank you so much. I appreciate you. But waste 1 second of your powerful, wonderful story that you have to tell. So we're going to get started, and I like to start from the very beginning, okay, and from the rooter to the tuber. Is that all right?
That's fine.
Okay. So now we're going to start with, you know, where you hail from, where you were born and raised. Let's start there.
Well, you know, I'm a product of Brooklyn, New York. My family's from Panama. My brother, my father, my mother were all born in Panama. They came over in the early days, and my dad came over first to try to make sure he can find a home for the family and in this good life here. And then he later on brought his wife over and my brother, Bill, over. And a few years after they had been here, I came along. So I hail from Brooklyn, but my roots go back to Panama.
Okay. So now I always like for everybody to shout out the schools that they went to, because people like to be able to relate and say, oh, I went to a school that Wayne Cobham went to. So shout your schools out for me.
Well, let's see. In Queens, up in PS 124, I went to Junior High School 202, Robert H. Goddard. I went to high school at John Adams, college up in Manhattan School of Music. I also did a little bit down at NYU for a bit. And then the School of the Streets, you know, where all my peeps out in Queens, the Jamaica Funk Cats, they really gave me the training I needed.
Okay, well, there you go. Now, here's what I want to know. Did the music bug first bite you? You know, like, what were your very earliest musical influence?
I guess that I'd have to start with my family. My dad was a Caribbean piano player. He wasn't professionally trained. His family could only afford to get one of the kids trained in how to play piano. So my uncle, my dad's brother, Uncle Edwin Cobham, he got the training. So my dad, being the younger brother, used to hang outside the room and watch his older brother get musically trained and learn. He'd pick it up by ear. So my dad was a great ear piano player. He played all the Caribbean tunes and later got into Art Tatum in a big way and the jazz greats, and he would try and replicate that. My mom, on the other side, was very religious in the church thing and loved to sing. So her background was singing in the choirs in various churches. And my brother started out playing drums in marching bands and actually in the Boy Scouts was his first influence. So I grew up listening to music in the house all the time, either on the radio or have family jams going on. And I always wanted to play like them. I aspired to play piano like my dad, but my dad was Caribbean. He was very strict. So back then, if you didn't hold your hands just right or if I didn't play that chord just right, you know, there was hell to pay. So I found that wasn't the way I needed to go. I wanted to emulate my brother and play some drums and some percussion like my brother, and that was kind of cool. But, you know, similarly, if I couldn't get that paradiddle or that flamencue just the way he wanted, there was hell to pay. We had an uncle that came up, was in the Army, and he came home with his Jeep, and my brother and I took us both for a ride in his Jeep, and that was so cool because, you know, riding an Army Jeep, that was great. But in the back of the Jeep was a bugle, and I took up this bugle for the first time, never seen one before, put it to my lips, and a note came out. And I said, well, wait a minute. And my brother tried to play it. He couldn't get nothing out of it. So I found my niche. I found my area of where I wanted to explore, because that way I can take my time, learn, make my mistakes, and everybody thought it was great. So that's where it started.
And there's no hell to pay.
That's it.
You didn't have to worry about it. You could take your time and do it, you know, as it came naturally, right?
Exactly.
So
as we got better, we started joining, you know, the streets got a little bit mean, and Mom wanted to keep us out of trouble, so we joined some drum and bugle corps, some marching bands that were local. St. Clement's Pope was where I began playing in a marching band. My brother was St. Catherine's of Siena, Queensman out in Queens. And then we both graduated into a senior corps, which was the Sunrisers out in Long Island, New York. And that's where we were able to hone the craft a little bit, become better players.
Okay. So how did the gospel aspect of music affect you at all when you were younger? I mean, you listened to Caribbean music a lot, but did the gospel, like, reach out to you in any kind of way? Did you, like, go to church with your mom and listen to her sing in the choir and stuff like
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. Yeah, and my mom and my grandma, they sang all the time in the house. And so all those old Negro spirituals and hymns we used to have to learn, and we used to know them by heart. Billy Graham was very big in the house. My grandmother loved him. So it was like, oh, how great thou art. We just would sing that and back and forth. So it was a wonderful time.
Okay, so your first musical influences were very diverse.
Very diverse.
Yeah. So that had a lot to do with how your musical flavor was shaped then, right?
Absolutely, you know, and then when we moved out of Brooklyn to Queens because, you know, wanted to get a better area for the kids to grow, you know, moved into Jamaica and Ozone Park and Jamaica area. And I think that's where everything started to come together quite a bit. We have we had a lot of stars coming out of that are today's stars that came out of Jamaica. We call them Jamaica Cats, but whereas I always joke about it, but it was really true. We didn't have gangs back then. We had bands. So if I knew Chocolate Banks and her band was going to be playing on the corner of 130th Street and Bedell's on Saturday, I would get my group Juice and we'd play on the other corner. So whoever could pull the crowd was the baddest band. So that's all we did. We just battled bands. And a lot of great musicians came out of the Queens, Jamaica area. And most of those were my teachers. They helped develop who I am today by listening and trying to learn and copy, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, these bands, when did you start playing? Did you form the bands or did you just, like, join bands that people ask you to, like, in high school that you started doing gigs, like, around town or locally or whatever?
started actually closer to junior high school with a band called Tempo, and then later into high school era with a group that was called Juice. We played, and yeah, we just had a ball.
Okay, so you guys, yeah, because here in California, on the West Coast, that we had battle of the bands all the time at like different high school functions, talent shows, and stuff like that. So
same here on the East Coast, we had a similar function. I mean, we had so many great bands. I mean, there was a co-op in the middle of Jamaica, Queens, called Rochdale Village. A lot of cats, they would come there and practice in some of the empty rooms and hone their skills and then get a chance to play for a dance or Battle of the Bands function in one of the main auditoriums. And we had a lot of great musicians that came out of there. Marcus Miller, Barry Johnson, the names go on and on of the cats came out of that neighborhood.
So now, how did you know that you were, of course, the trumpet obviously came natural to you, but how did you know, like from the reaction of your peers or an audience or whoever, that you could really actually play this instrument? You know, loving to play an instrument doesn't necessarily mean that you know how to do it just because you love to do it. So at some point, you know, somebody told you that you knew what you were doing and recruited you and all that. So when did you first get that inkling that you were good, you were actually good, you knew what you were doing, and people, you know, recognized that?
Well, when we started playing, you know, we grew up playing in backyards and in basements, and our parents and our friends would listen to us, and they would give us our props, and they were the ones who would bolster us up and say, you guys got it. And we thought we were doing it. And then we'd get hired out to some gigs, or we'd play at a dance or a club. And, you know, we kind of sort of know we were getting it on. We were getting it together, and we started seeing the reaction of the crowd and the people out and on a dance floor. So we knew we had something going. Initially, it was really imitative. You know, whoever was the new group out there that was playing, when Kool and the Gang came out and they were dropping their first tune that made it really big in the neighborhood, which was called Kool and the Gang back then, everybody had to know it. Every band had to play it, and whoever played it best was on the right track, you know. So that's how we did it. We really imitated a lot and learned by imitation.
Mm-hmm. Like everybody does. Now, of course, your older brother, right?
That's true.
Billy Cobham, okay? Everybody knows who he is. So now, did you ever play in bands with him?
You know, it wasn't, not initially, not until I got older. Bill's 7 years older than me, so I was always baby brother.
Okay.
But, you know, a lot of my development, I got a chance to listen to his development. When he was coming up playing from Horace Silver, the Jazz Samaritans, the Marvis New Orchestra, all of his developmental years, you know, I was baby brother hanging out. He had to mind me because mom and dad were off to work, so he had to go make his rehearsals, and he had to drag me along because, you know, I had to go check it out. So I got a chance to see those formative years of Bill's career and learn, and my brother's, and that association and being able to do that was great for me because I got the chance to see it and feel it. But it wasn't until I got a little older that he gave me a chance to do some playing with him, so that was great.
Okay. And how awesome was that you had to, well, at that time, I know he didn't probably appreciate it that much that he had to drag you along with him, but how awesome was that for you that you could actually be there and like, you know, soak all that in by osmosis, so to speak, you know what I'm saying? That's a musician's dream come true, right? You know, right there, to be able to just all the time be around music and let it, and you wanted to be a musician too. So how excited were you to be able to do that?
I think that was ultra important for me, and we did it regularly. Once he got out of the Army, he did a little stint with in the United States Army. But when I got a chance to hang with him and through the I'd say back first with the Drum and Bugle Corps years, because Bill was always a great player. He came out of the womb playing drums and playing them pretty great. But when he first went to his first senior drum and bugle corps, which was the Sunrisers, he was this hot kid that everyone was talking about who could play. But when he got there, there was other guys there that could also play. And first, I remember one rehearsal, first rehearsal he took me to with him. There was a snare drummer that was there, and he challenged Bill. He said, "Well, I heard you're supposed to be a badass player, you know, but can you do the single stroke roll?" And he did it real fast with one hand. And Bill tried it, and it wasn't as fast as this guy. And the guy says, "Well, you know, what about with the other hand?" And again, Billy tried it, and it wasn't as fast as this guy. And he says, "Well, you'll move to the front of the line when you can get your when you get your stuff together." You know,
mm-hmm.
Bill came home and he practiced, and he practiced. He practiced on stuff that wouldn't bounce back. He'd play on phone books. He'd play on tables. He played on everything he'd get his chance to play on, until he developed a style where he could be quick, responsive, and it was just like a blur. And it took him about a couple of months of playing, practicing, and he came back to the same gentleman. He said, you think you got something? And Bill started to play, and when Bill did it, he played it, did backstick in action, all kinds of twirling stuff. The cat never saw that before. And Bill was born. You know, he had that competitive edge, and he put that out there, and it was great. And I was like, wow. You know, he gained his respect, and he moved up to the front of the line because he worked for it. So the work ethic thing was heavy, and we had to move forward with that. I watched that. I watched that all through those years of the formative years with Bill through his drum and bugle corps years. He really got a break when Horace Silver picked him up and took him under his wing, and he started really playing jazz with Horace. Before that, he had a band called the Jazz Samaritans, which was great, with George Cables and those boys, Artie Simmons. They were great, and it just progressed.
Well, and that's my point. My point is how wonderful that was for you to be able to, you know, grow up watching and listening and studying, you know, and since he had a work ethic like that, I mean, of course you were going to have one like that too, and that did nothing but help everything that you did as far as your career went, I'm sure. So now, okay, so now you're playing in bands throughout high school, right? You're in some of the baddest bands, obviously. So after high school, then what? What were you doing?
Well, I wanted to learn how to play jazz. You know, I'd gone to a club that was really close to where I grew up in this co-op called Rochdale Village. It's called the Village Door. Village Door, the St. Albans, Queens area, and the Jamaica area is where a lot of the stars used to come after working in at their jazz gigs and things in Manhattan. They'd come home to St. Albans and rest and sleep and play at some of the clubs, and there's quite a few. But the Village Door was one that would allow young cats to come in and try out their craft. My mom put some money together, sent me off to Manhattan School of Music. I was trying to learn jazz under a gentleman by the name of Dan Massigliano, who was doing the jazz class there. And I thought I had my stuff together, and I walked into this club called the Village Door, and a drummer named Walter Perkins, he's a major force in my life and pointing me in the right direction. Walter had a little quartet and was in there playing, and he asked him if I could sit in. He agreed. I don't remember what the song was, but after I finished playing, Walter said, "Hey, kid, you know, come here, I want to talk to you." I said, "Great, man. I got one of the jazz greats of all time going to talk to me." He says, "He said, where do you go to school?" I said, "Manhattan School of Music." And he says, "Yeah, I thought so." And I was like, "Wow." He says, "So when you going to learn how to play some jazz?" I was like, "What?" He says, "You know, I don't know what you were playing, man, but that was you got some tone, man. But all those notes, you were triple tongue and all that was BS, man. When you gonna learn how to play some jazz?" And now I'm stunned. And he says, "He says, who do you like?" And I said, "Well, you know, I like Miles Davis. I like to listen to Dizzy, and I really love Freddie Hubbard's tone." He says, "Well, why don't you go home and learn? Why don't you listen to some Miles records? Listen to some Dizzy records. If you like Freddie, listen to Freddie's songs. Come back here when you know something. Don't come back here without knowing something, because you sounded like crap, man. You got great tone and you got potential, but you ain't got it." And I think I cried all the way home. But it was great. Mm-hmm. It was tough love. He put me on the path because, yeah, I was book learning it, but I wasn't feeling it. And, mm-hmm. and he put me on a path, and it took me a minute to get it together. It wasn't right away. You know, I started listening to Freddie Hubbard's Red Clay album. I love Freddie because he had a great tone, and that's what I used to like to emulate. My brother, fortunately, had a gig with Freddie for a period of time, so I got a chance to see that, see him up front and live. And then, you know, it took me maybe a year or so to come back and see him again, and I played, and he says, now you're getting a kid. Now you're starting to understand what's going on. And that was great. Tough love.
And how old were you about around this time?
About 17, 18 years old.
Well, okay, well, you know, you were still young, so you were still learning. So, okay, you came back after a year, so okay. So now you have it a little bit better under your belt, and so where to go from there?
Well, then, you know, by that time, my band Juice, we had a chance. A gentleman, a producer by the name of Stan Vincent, whose claim to fame was producing the Five Stair Steps Ooh Child record, took a liking to us and wanted to produce a single that we wanted to do, and he did. We chose a Burt Bacharach tune called Walk On By, and went in the studio with Stan, and he produced it, and you know, came out with our first 45. We thought we were going to be dynamic stars, you know, because
right.
We had Stan. Record came out, you know, and died probably just as quickly, you know. So it was like one of those situations like, oh, man. So, well, we didn't stop. We kept playing, trying to forge our way through the industry and the biz. Some of the members of our band, we started getting older now. We couldn't hang out at home anymore. And our parents started saying, well, you know, you can't keep doing this music stuff. Y'all better get yourself real jobs or go back to school.
Right.
And that became the thing, you know. So a lot of us broke off and did a thing. My best buddy worked for Transit. I had another guy work for the Water Department. I myself personally did a stint with New York City Police Department for a minute, you know, just trying to make sure that some bills were paid and as we were growing up could do some things. And but still kept playing and looking for every opportunity to play and learn.
And you did also said you joined the military for a minute. Is that what you're saying?
No, I joined the New York City Police Department.
Oh, okay. All right. So how long did this phase last? This, you know, get a job phase, make that money phase.
I did 4 years with New York City Police Department.
Okay,
and,
4 years. Okay.
4 years, and then in my. It was kind of rocky, but it was interesting in as much as that I was stationed up at police headquarters, One Police Plaza at the time in New York, and on my breaks I used to practice my trumpet in the break room, and then I had a sergeant that was kind of hard on me. He kept telling me that it was against the rules for anyone to play a trumpet on their break, and I said, well, you know, why is this against the rules, Sergeant? And he said, well, because I said so. And, you know, so he kicked me around different tours from 12-day tour. And so I wouldn't see him, and I continued to play. And then he caught me again, and he wrote me up for playing my horn, and I said, okay. Then I did something I probably shouldn't have done. I wrote a letter to the Deputy Police Commissioner at the time, and I said, hey, you know, I'm PO so-and-so, and I play my horn on my breaks. Is there any rules against that? And they wrote me a glowing letter back, said, no, man, it's inspirational for the guys. I've heard about you. That kind of situation. And lo and behold, I was playing my horn, and my sergeant came and saw me playing. He was going to write me up, and I whipped out this letter. And he said, oh, so you went over my head. Now you're going to rue today. So he just stayed on my case forever. I had a chance, a gig with the Stylistics. They were going to St. Thomas for about a month, and they needed a trumpet player. And I was like, man, I really want to do this hit. But I didn't have a month's worth of time, of leave time, of vacation time with the police department. So I kicked it with my brother, and he said, well, you know, maybe you're at a point in your life where you have to make a decision. Are you going to be a policeman, and you're going to be a musician? And I chose the music route. Went out with Stylistic, did a month, came back maybe 7 months later.
Mm-hmm. So that was your first, what you could call, professional gig, right?
That was my first professional big gig with a name artist, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so did you have to audition for that gig?
I kind of did in a strange kind of way. I had hooked up with some brothers out of New York that were very influential in my career. They were called the Best of Friends. They owned a string of clubs between New York and D.C. The New York club, the mainstay, the flagship club, was called Leviticus. They had clubs in Brooklyn. They had clubs down in D.C. as well. And I was tasked with putting together a house band because all of the name acts that came through New York wanted to play, especially the R&B acts, wanted to play Leviticus. So whether it was the Whispers, the Moments, whomever, they came through Leviticus. And as such, we put together, I was tasked with putting together a band to back up whoever came in. But more so than that, to stand on our own, there was a house act that we had of three singers called Chaz that we put a band together to back up. And then there's also some singers, some female singers called Lamel, which was included Cindy Mizell, Lisa Fisher, and a young lady named Jackie Wimper, and they were great. And
Lisa Fisher in there, I know they were great. She's awesome.
Oh man, all these young ladies, they were killing. And we had the band, and I had the finest of New York's talent was in that band, and we rehearsed heavy, and we played hard, and you know, if you came to the club, you knew you had to step your game up. When it came to Leviticus,
mm-hmm.
And it was that association with the promoters and they used to come through there. They used to see the band that I had and hear me play. That's how I got that gig.
Okay, so now you're in the big time, right? Did you feel like you were on your way and this is the big time?
I was hoping it would be, you know, but, you know, life always has its twists and turns. Even the gig that I took to go out to St. Thomas and play with the Stylistics, when we got out there, we played a period of time, but, you know, there was a problem with the promoter, the band totally didn't get paid, so it was a hang-up, you know. So I had to spend some extra time in St. Thomas, which was good learning lessons for me, life lessons for me. Learning how to play. I played with every island band I could to earn enough money to get back to New York because I really didn't have money to get back. That's how bad it was at that minute. But it was cool.
Well, you know, that's a familiar story because I have gone through something like that before myself. So I absolutely understand that. So, but the cool part about it was since you were in St. Thomas, right?
It was St. Thomas. It was beautiful.
So they were playing Caribbean music, right?
Caribbean music straight up. I was the Yankee trumpet player, and we played straight Caribbean music all day, all night.
That's what I was going to say. You had listened to that while you were growing up, so that should have been a piece of cake to do.
It was a lot of fun to do. You know,
yeah.
And then, yep.
So then you came back to New York? And
came back.
What?
Came back to New York and started hitting it, looking for any work I could because I needed to get a job. I had to pay some bills, pay some rent, car notes, and started taking pretty much any gig that I could find. Got a job working at one of New York's largest on 48th Street in Manhattan. I went into a Sam Ash music store. I knew the owner, and I spoke to him and said, listen, you know, I need a job, and he was like, You don't need a job, man. You're going to go out on tour. I know you don't need it. I said, no. You know, I have a girlfriend that's about to have a baby, and I need a job. I got to settle my stuff down. And I took a job working for Sam Ash on 48th Street, and that also opened tons of doors for me because I started meeting people and just spreading the word about who and what I could do around. So it was good. It was good for me.
So that's real important because so many times it's not what you can do, it's absolutely who you know. So that's, you know what I'm saying, a lot of times it seems unfair, but that's just the way it is. Now, when I asked you to give me a list of songs that were your favorites, you submitted a list, and on the first song is called A Smile. Is that correct?
A smile.
So now, did you write this song?
I wrote part of it. I wrote it in conjunction with a talented brother here in New York. He's a multi-instrumentalist. His name is Brother Dot Deep. We met on the internet, and we we just hit it off. His music and my collaboration with him, and that tune just was our first process, one of the first things we came up with, and released it. It was on iTunes and made a little bit of noise out there, and ultra talented.
So how long ago was this?
Our Smile was released about 2 years ago.
Okay, good. So this is what we're getting ready to listen to, A Smile. This very pretty song. And here we go, A Smile, bam. I wish I knew a little bit. Been humming right along with your trumpet part right there. So I'm going to have to listen back.
You know it.
Huh?
We can go back and do a remix. We can put you on there, Chocolate.
Now, don't start nothing that you can't finish, okay? Because I'm ready. I stay ready. Just so that you know, your girl stays ready, okay? So that was beautiful. Love that one. A Smile. Love that one. Now we have some callers on the line. Are you ready to take a phone call?
Sure.
Okay, so we have a caller from area code 305. 305, are you there? Uh-oh, maybe we... Okay, so we have another one. I think 305 hung up. So let's go with area code 816. 816, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, so I'm just going to say right now, Wayne, this is Barry Jackson. Barry Jackson, this is Wayne Cobham. And
how are you?
Barry, we're Facebook friends.
That's absolutely true.
Yep. I was just. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing well, man. I'm blessed. I'm here doing what I do and loving it, so I'm good.
When Chocolate posted up that you were going to be on the show, I said, well, that's pretty good. I got Billy. She got Wayne. And I was going to ask, did you play in St. Catherine's Drum and Bugle Corps, too?
Yes, I did.
Okay, because that's how I introduced Billy when I did the interview with him. He fell out laughing.
That's funny.
But let me ask you, you mentioned during the first part of your conversation with Chocolate, you know, some of the trumpet players that somebody suggested you listen to so you could get more into jazz. And I just wanted to know, was there anything specific that you were asked to listen for and that you got out of listening, you know, when you were listening to, you know, like Miles and the other trumpet players that were suggested to you?
Well, you know, I think I love listening to it. One of the greatest trumpet players, I think, of all time was Louis Armstrong, with just the things he was able to do and play, the different styles that he was able to play, and his control, his mastery of the instrument was always of amazement to me. But as I was coming up, you know, Billy did Bitches Brew, so I got a chance to get into that era of Miles and listen to that record and those things he was doing, and Miles' pre-bop era and the hard bop era. I was listening to Miles a lot. But I also dug Dizzy, too, because they were both great trumpet players, but different. For me, Dizzy would play, but Dizzy had a lot of lyricism. He was funny. He played some things that were really bopping his behind off, but then he'd throw a little lyrical lick in there that was cute. And he also had tremendous range. He could play high notes with anybody back in the day, and they were just great. Clifford was also great. But I think the person that really nailed it for me was Freddie, and Freddie from a position of tone. I didn't find anybody who had a prettier sound than Freddie Hubbard on his flugelhorn and his trumpet. When he wanted to play a ballad, wow, his overall tone was something that endeared me. So if I had to think of somebody that I was trying to emulate or copy, you know, I tried to copy Freddie. My brother had a chance to be playing with Freddie on some Freddie dates when he was on the CTI label. And being the little brother, being tagged along, you know, I got a chance to meet Mr. Hubbard and get backstage and, you know, Mr. Hubbard, you know, that solo you did on Red Clay, that was great. And then he looked at the little kid and he says, of course it was great. I'm Freddie Hubbard. You know? So, you know, but it was great. And you know Freddie, and that's just how Freddie was. But the sound.
Yeah.
So I would go home. You know, Freddie back in the day played a flugelhorn by a company called Queen on Star. So I had to have a Queen on Star. You know, because Freddie played it. I knew it was a quality instrument, and he got that sound. So I wanted to get that sound. So I went out and bought me a Queen on Star, and that's what it was. That's what it was about. You know. You know, imitation was the greatest part of flattery and the best way to learn. You know, for me, it was a method for me to learn a little bit more how to speak the language, you know.
Did you post a picture up a couple of years ago? You did a little stint with Brass Construction?
Yes, I did some stuff with Brass Construction. I'm all over. I like to play. And the genre of music, you know, I guess I want to have fun. Playing music and the whole musical element of my life is about having some fun and learning. And I was able to do some hits with Brass Construction, and that was a lot of fun for me.
Yeah, my last question, and then I'm going to get off of here. I thought I saw a YouTube video of a performance with Billy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are you and Billy the only musicians in the – I mean, of the brothers and sisters in the family?
Yeah, yes. Billy and I are the only children in the family of my father.
Okay.
And
okay.
That was it. My mom thought she had a girl when I came along, and when she didn't get it, she said, "Okay, that's enough. I'm not doing this anymore."
Then we had similar. We were born under similar circumstances. I was going to be Pam, because I was going to be Pamela.
Well, my mom had
anyway.
My father was William Emanuel Cobham Sr., so Billy was William Emanuel Cobham Jr. So the WEC thing kept going on, and when I was born, she had to think of something, so I became Wayne Edison Cobham. So all of us kept that initial thing going. She had a plan.
Okay. I heard that.
All right. Yes, ma'am.
Did you find out everything you needed to know?
Yeah, and I promise one of his next interviews will be with yours truly. So, you know, we've been talking about it and on back and forth, and now I got the motivation, especially since you got in first.
Okay. Well, I forever thank you for your support, and thank you so much for calling in.
Sure. All right.
Okay.
Take care. All right.
Well,
I'd
be remiss if I didn't say that, like I mentioned to you before when we were talking off the air, you're an inspiration as well. You know, I was dead up front and center at Madison Square Garden when GCS came out and with their first album, you know, and I was like, wow, you know, yeah, I heard you do your funk box thing, and I Can't Stand the Rain. Yo, okay.
Well, thank you, Wade. I appreciate that, you know, because, you know, I'm just a little tiny bit. Let me put it this way. I thought I was going to be a little tiny bit out of my element because of this jazz thing. I thought that you were mainly a jazz musician, but after I read about you and started investigating you and saw how diverse your background and your history and your story was, it's like, oh no, he wears many hats, and by the way, everybody likes the hat you wear, and so you have done everything. So I cannot wait to get to the funk part of I'm calling the funk part, because to me R&B and soul and all that and gospel and all that, they're all cousins. So, you know, they were all born of one. So, you know, and you started out playing cover tunes, like you said. So I'm doing this jazz thing for those, because I do have funk tunes out there that like jazz. So I'm giving them what they like. So I'm going to let them hear another song, and then it's about to get real funky after this next song, which is going to be Heather. Now, can you tell me a little bit about this song, Heather?
Yeah, Heather is a tune that I fell in love with. It was written by my brother Billy. It was released on his Crosswinds album, and it really endeared me. The soloist at that time on Billy's version was Michael Brecker, and he just killed the song. It's like, there's nothing else I could think about that I could say that I think I could outdo that. But I had a vision in my mind of a direction that I'd like to take the song, and I was able to get Billy in line on this track with me and play as well. So Najee Allen Gums played, Kevin Ellis played bass, and a gentleman named Victor Wayne played guitar for me. Victor Wayne Jeffries played guitar on the track, and I did the flugelhorn part, and this was my attempt to bring that tune back.
Okay, well, here we go. This song is called Heather. You better hold that note. I see, with a song like that, what I want to do is I want it to be raining outside. I want to have a glass of, like, my favorite whatever it is I'm drinking at the time and sitting in front of a fireplace. You know, that's the kind of mood that, you know, songs like that put me in, like, you know, real romantic type stuff. You know what I'm saying? So,
exactly.
And that's what it's meant to do. Is that what it's meant to do?
That's what it's meant to be. That's what I was trying to hit. That's the note I was trying to get out there. It's some emotion. And, yeah. And sounding pretty, making the horn sound pretty.
It worked for me. Okay, now, here we come to the 70s. Here we come to the 70s. Now, computer programming was just beginning, and you became one of the pioneers. You were a major part of the MIDI revolution and started a business, a productive business, as a consultant, producer, educator. So tell us about that. Tell us about what that was like.
You know, that's an interesting part of my life. I was story goes, I was dating somebody who was a singer, but who worked for an airline company and liked to sing, and they wanted me to produce them as a singer, but they never really was taking it serious to me. They weren't putting in the proper amount of hours to become a singer and of that nature. But one thing they could really do, and they could do great, was type, and they were a fantastic typist on a typewriter back then, because really pre a lot of computer stuff. And so I said, well, okay, you know, word processing was just coming out, you know, and the big thing at the time was a system called Wang, and then IBM came out with an XT and an AT machine, and they wanted to learn how to become a word processor, you know, start a new business. So I assisted them to go through some training for that, to learn this Wang machine. And as a Christmas gift that year, asked them what they wanted. They said, well, I want my own computer. It's a computer. So what's a computer? And they said, well, had to have 64K and 2 5-and-a-quarter floppies. And I said, okay, cool. I got that. It was in my mind. And like I said before, I had been working on 48th Street in Manhattan, and there was a music store I walked past one day, and it had an Apple IIe computer in the window, and it said 64K, and it said 2 5-and-a-quarter floppies. I said, oh, that's a computer. Great. This is what my girl would want. So I bought it, and I think I remember the price was still somewhere around $2,400 at the time for this machine. Bought it, wrapped it up, delivered it for Christmas, and when she ripped the paper off, she says, what's that? And I said, hey, that's your computer. You said you want a computer. She said, that's not a Wang, that's not an IBM. I said, no. You said 64K, 2 5-and-a-quarter floppies, that's what that is. And she said, that's not it. And she just, like, poo-pooed it and walked away. And it pretty much sat there with a dust cover on it for about a good 6 months until a really good friend of mine and a great musician, his name is Benny Russell. He was in New York. He's now out of Baltimore, Maryland. And he came by my house one day with a magazine called Soft Talk. And he came in the house. He said, hey, man, you got the same computer that Herbie Hancock programmer, Brian Bell, uses to make music. And I said, what? Music on a computer? No. He says, yeah. And he gave me this magazine. And I started inhaling the magazine. I started reading this magazine about programming this Apple IIe computers. And back in that day, the computer was able to, you was able to pop the top of a 2E, put in daughter boards into the multiple slots in there and create something. So I bought some of these daughter boards from a company called Mountain, stuck it in there, and now it's turned this innocent computer into a 16-voice polyphonic computer, synthesizer, really. And that I started doing that, and at the time, Apple, to draw the waveforms on to create new sounds, you needed joysticks. Apple had discontinued the joysticks. So I was looking at this code again, and somehow the numbers seemed to make sense to me, so I devised a way of automatically creating a sine wave or a square or a sawtooth wave so that I can create my sounds and create patches for the synthesizer. And my buddy again, Benny Russell, God bless him, he came over and said, man, you should let the company know what you're doing, man. You can make some money behind that. And I said, yeah, right. But lo and behold, I took his advice. I sent out a letter to a company called, at the time it was called Master Tracks. Password Designs was a company, and I sent them my little letter and a floppy disk with what I had done. And they sent me back a letter and $350. Say, hey, man, this is great. We'd like to use it. We want to put you on our software technology board. And I said, well, whoa, that was great. So what that did was, you know, anytime something came out new, they'd send it to me. First, I'd try it. I got on the Apple Music music team at the time, working with Apple on some of the things they were doing as well. And that was cool because if they had a new product, I got it first. I got a chance to beta test and then do a dry run with it. And I remember a salesman for Passport coming to me one day and said, you know, there's a new thing coming out that's going to revolutionize music. I said, well, what's that? He says, MIDI. I said, well, what is that? He said, well, music instrument digital interface. I said, okay, again, what does that mean? He said, well, that means you can take, you know, you take a Yamaha thing and you can plug it into a Korg. Plug the Korg into an Akai. When you play the Akai, they all are going to sound. I said, that is never going to work. They'll never think about that stuff. And lo and behold, it actually did. And, you know, and the rest became history. We were pioneering things of that nature back then. You know, the drum machines were proliferating all around. There was the Linn drums. There was the Drumulators. There was the, you know, the DMXs. Everything was out there, but they all had different time clocks associated with them. So if you wanted to sync them to in a studio to drop a track, you kind of had to know what you were doing. And trial and error and reading a lot helped me a lot. And that stuck me out in the forefront of learning what I was doing. And I did it for my brother and some other artists. Did my brother's Warning album. We did that way. And you know, folks are calling me the computer guy. Hey, man, call Wayne. He's the computer guy. He can get it done. And that's where it started.
And you know what I think is great, and the reason why I had to laugh is because for the past however long you've been talking, 5 minutes, I do not understand. It is like you've been speaking Japanese. But I know the results of it. I know the results of it. And the fact that you were like, in on it at the beginning, and you played a very integral part too. You know what I'm saying? And you were there from the beginning. You know that's the part that blows my mind. So now, who did you first? What musician did you first work with that used this? And you guys made a hit record. It became a you know, you did something successful with it. Tell me that about that.
Well, we did some things. Wow. Again, my brother was the first experiment. We did I used the Apple IIe computer, and then we moved up to a Macintosh SE30 to do Billy's Warning album for his company there, for GRP. I started working, doing a lot of things with samples. You know, sampling was coming into its fore, and I became a nut about sampling and coming up with different sounds for sampling, and that was always had a little bit of an endorsement with the Akai company, and so I would just do a lot of samples and trial and error things, you know, putting going in a gymnasium in high school and having somebody bounce a basketball, for instance, and sampling that sound or recording that sound, right, and then using the attack and the ambience of that sound and marrying it with a bass drum or a kick drum in a track. And that gave a different sound, a different ambience. So I started doing that and selling samples and doing things for a lot of folks. And an influential brother who helped me out and took me to the next level was Teddy Riley. I started doing a lot of – Teddy used to come and buy a lot of samples for me and loop for me. And the rest was kind of history, to coin the phrase.
Tell that story that you told me off air about Teddy.
Teddy used to, well, I had a studio. I had a little recording studio that was on Broadway in Manhattan. Teddy was a kid that used to come up every now and then, and I was introduced to him by a group called the Aleem Brothers, and he would come up and he'd use a recording studio up there, and he wanted to borrow a DMX, and he'd borrow my Stretch, and we could do some recordings with it. And every time I got it back, if he borrowed it over the weekend, he rented it from me. When it came back, it was slamming beats. I was like, how could he even construct this? You know, how could he think of this? And Teddy was always that guy, and he still is to this day, I believe. And Teddy is has the capability of writing a groove that you want to dance to. You may think it's, but today you might think, that's not hip, but you're going to dance to it like crazy next week or next year, because he was a visionary. He knew what people wanted to dance to well in advance. And that whole revolution with Jack Swing and everything he's done since then is a testament to, you know, the power of what he's done and his mark in the music industry. So I was kind of glad to be a part of that, or a helping hand and helping him shape some of that in the early days.
Well, the story y'all was talking about was how he called you about a gig that he had, but you told him you had a gig with somebody else. And remember?
I was working. I was getting ready to do some. I was doing some stuff, a lot of stuff with Guy, and we are doing a lot of music sampling and programming for Guy. And then I had an opportunity to go out with Keith Sweat, and I told him I was going to go out with Keith Sweat and do some work. And he said, "No, man, you know, you got to come with me and Guy, man, because you know we really need you." And I said, "Nah, but Keith is going to pay me some good money." He says, "Look, I got something for you, man. I'm going to put you down on the Michael Jackson project." And I said, "Whoa, bye, Keith." You know. So I said, one of my boys, a good friend of mine, Rod Jonathan, same, went and did the Keisha thing and did really good with that. But, yeah, and Teddy opened that door for me to work with him on with Michael.
He opened that door, and he opened a big door, too, because you worked on two of Michael Jackson's albums, Dangerous and History, and you won Grammys. You got Grammys for working on those projects, and also for working on Denise Williams' project too. So you have three Grammys doing that. I don't know how many you have altogether, but you have those three. So because Dangerous is one of my favorite albums of Michael Jackson's, we're gonna play the song. I threw it in. I hope you don't mind, but we're going to play the song Jam. Now, tell me about Jam, because that sounds, all the stuff that you were just talking about, it sounds like every single bit of that, those elements are in that song Jam.
That's, Jam is an interesting song. I mean, and the project as a whole, as it began, we migrated. I was into doing the Apple thing. Teddy was very heavy into doing Atari computers. Atari had just come out with an Atari laptop. And I had racks and racks of sample gear that I still own, S900s, S1000s, Roland samplers et al. And we started coming up with samples and grooves that we thought would work. We recorded them into an Atari laptop using Cubase at the time. And getting ready for this project with Michael. And then we figured, well, we needed to have a second one just in case something happened with the first one. You know, we had wanted to have a backup computer. And,
right.
So we took two computers out, and Michael flew all my gear out. And at the time, I didn't have road cases or anything for it. It was in my studio. But since it was going to be an integral part of the project, I have four 20 Space Calzone floating rack cases with all my gear. They trucked my stuff out to California, and we programmed up that album, man, and the rest is history. It was really great.
Okay. All right. Well, let's hear Jam, Michael, because this is one of my favorite ones. So here we go.
Okay.
You wanna get up?
That's a good memory. You know, I mean, for all the technophiles out there, I mean, if you listen to that album, that's either an album version or a CD version, you listen to what Teddy and Michael did with the tracks, and the B-side, which was another producer, there's an audible difference in sound, sound level without distortion. The tunes, all those tunes that Teddy worked on for Michael on Dangerous in History, they're slamming. They're slamming at a higher volume and a mid-range rate than some of the other tracks, but they don't distort. And that's, that's to the talents of Teddy Riley and Michael. They pulled that off.
Yes, they absolutely did. Now, you are part of a revolution, but that wasn't enough for you. You didn't stop there. On top of everything else you were doing, you were also in high demand as a performer, and you were touring around the world playing with people like Benny King, The Temptations, Lil Anthony and the Imperial, Four Tops. I'm not going to try to name them all. Ray Charles, Kool and the Gang, Nancy Wilson. Now, and also some of your studio credits include, of course, Michael, like we just said, Peaches of a Dream, Patty Austin, your brother. But what I want to know about is when you were on tour as the musical director for Wilson Pickett.
Uh-oh.
And his band, the Midnight Movers. Now, you told me a story. I don't know if you remember, but you told me a story of and I know Wilson Pickett was a character, and you told me this story about you guys playing, I think it was someplace burning up hot, I want to say Florida.
No, we actually We're playing. We had a blues gig to do in Arizona. It was like, you know, 99,000 degrees in the day, and it was hard keeping the instruments in tune. But we had to play that night. We came on. I think Little Richard was also on the bill, and he came on right in front of us, and we were getting to come on and play. And I mean, it was a summer blues festival, and the Wilson and the Midnight Movers band. We were dressed up in tuxedos. We were dressed to the nines. We were looking good, and we could play. So one of the band members asked me if I can go to Wilson, and, you know, it was so hot, could we lose the jackets, you know, at least take the jackets off and perform. So it made sense to me. So, you know, I went to the man. I said, yo, Wilson, any possibility we could, you know, like, lose the jackets tonight? And he cussed me out. He said, this ain't Wayne Cobham band. Who the hell do you think you are? This is the Wilson Pickett mother band. So this is what we're going to do. You know, and I said, I got it. So he ripped me a new orifice, and I said, okay. I went back to the band, and I said, no, man, jackets, we do what we do. This is what we're going to do. This is what we look for. This is what the man's paying for. This is where we're going to go. We get on stage. We get ready to play. The curtains open up to maybe 15, 20,000 people sitting out there on chairs and in the grass waiting for us. And that first gasp of air, you know, the people just went, and when they did that gasp, I understood. I got it. I learned a lesson, a major lesson that day. It wasn't about what I wanted to look like, or it was what the crowd wanted to see. We won. Mm-hmm. We didn't know, but we won that night. And then once we started playing, the band was hot, Wilson was hotter. He didn't dress down. He didn't give the crowd any less than he wanted to give them. He gave them the top of what he wanted to. So it was a life lesson for me. You know, I was like, yeah, you know, we could have taken our jackets off, but that would have cheapened who we were in his eyes and who he wanted the band to be as the Midnight Movers. So it was a good lesson for me.
The Midnight Movers. So tell me how you got that gig.
A great sax player in New York, his name was Siraj Al Hassan, told me that Wilson was looking for needed a trumpet player to add. He was at the time he was traveling with just two saxes, and he wanted to add a trumpet. So he called me down to a rehearsal, and I auditioned and wound up getting the gig. Then that's how that started, that career. But I didn't work on the musical directorship until like the latter years of his life. We had some good shows with Wilson. It was all good. It was all a learning session, but it wasn't the easiest guy to work with either. So that's, you know, but everybody knows
and,
that. That's what they call him.
And that's what I wanted to know. I wanted to know if you could just give us, you know, kind of like, okay, that was that one story you just told us, that gave us a little glimpse. But that's what I wanted to know is, you know, what was it like working for Wilson Pickett?
You know, to me, in hindsight, as I look back, though, I mean, we had definitely had stressful times. The band was, as was all his bands, I believe, that carried the name the Midnight Movers Band. I think all of the bands were great bands. Every iteration that he had were great bands. They call us Wilson Pickett's Badass Band, the Midnight Movers, because, again, we had some of New York's finest musicians in that band, and we took no prisoner. But as such, working with Wilson was always a little bit rough. We got fired in Germany, I remember. We had a German gig, and the band had to play three numbers up front. And one of the tunes we played was Brick House. That was an opening number, and during that song, the sax player, dancer, piano, and guitar player just start trading fours. It was soloing back and forth between each other, and crowd was getting very excited and screaming and hollering for the band, and we're going crazy. And I look back at the curtain, and Wilson had his head through the curtain, and he's signaling me to cut the band, you know, because we were raising too much sand out there, and then,
right.
Then he brought me back, and he said, you know, again, gave me one of those Wilson lectures. This is not the Wayne Cobham GD band. This is the Wilson Pickett MF band. And he fired us all. I said, you fired us? He says, yeah, I'll get me another damn band. Get out. I want everybody out. And it didn't. It was kind of sudden, but it was, you know, after every show, one thing, no matter what country we played in, Wilson paid us right away.
Mm-hmm.
everybody had been paid already, and he said he's firing us, he's getting rid of us. I said, are you sure? I said, we got a whole tour to go through. You firing us? He said, yeah, I'm going to get me another band. I can get a band any damn time. Get out. Okay, so I told the boys and girls, I said, let's pack up, let's go. Yeah. The middle of the night, I get a call from Wilson's bodyguard. He wanted to come see me, which was always a skeptical moment because you never knew what was going to happen in one of those meetings. And he apologized, and he hired us all back, and we continued the tour. Yeah, but it was always very interesting with Wilson, you know.
Oh, my God, that's hilarious to me. That's so funny. I hear so many stories like that about different artists that, you know, had those kind of temperaments. And it was just all part of it. And you worked for him like how many years?
About a good 7.5 years. You know.
A good 7.5 years. So in those 7.5 years, how many times do you think you got fired?
Oh, we got fired maybe like a good 3 or 4 times. He might have fired. I think another Wilsonism. The band, he wanted the band to play in Portugal for New Year's Eve, and so we said great, we'll do it. But he wanted to pay us New York City kind of money, not even a New Year's Eve kind of money, to go to Portugal. So the band rebelled. We said, you know, hell no, we're not going to Portugal on New Year's Eve away from our families for chump change. You know, you have to pay. And again, he threatened to get another band, and he couldn't. So he wound up taking us over. We did a great hit. It was wonderful. About 2 weeks later, he hired the band to play. We had to play in Wolf Trap in Virginia. And he said, okay, got the band coming down to Wolf Trap. So it was a New York City band. He drove us all the way down to Wolf Trap to do the hit. After the hit, as he always did, he paid us. Then he said, now go home. He didn't book any hotel rooms for us. He didn't book rooms for us. We did the hit, and he told us to go home. So we finished the hit. We had to drive all the way back to New York. There was nothing available for us. So that was his way of getting back at us.
Oh, my God. That Wilson Pickett. Okay, well.
Those are the clean ones. That's fine. I can keep those clean.
I'm a big fan of Wilson. Always has been. But I knew that he was a character, and I love stories like this. I love them, and because I love to learn things about people that you don't know. You know what I'm saying? I don't want to hear nothing about what I already know. Tell me something I don't know. So now one of my favorite songs is The Midnight Hour by Wilson Pickett.
Wilson Pickett.
And I know the Midnight Movers must have Kill that song.
Great pocket, great backbeat, great song. Classic.
Great song. And the horn part to die for. Okay, so here we go, Wilson Pickett. We playing this just for you, Midnight Hour. Can't fire nobody.
I'm gonna take you to the grave.
Hey, don't get no better than that. You talk
that was
about
a good one.
Song. Ooh, getting your groove on right there. Okay, so time is flying. So here's what I need to know. I need to know, what are you doing right now? What's going on in your life right now?
Well,
I know it's something, a whole bunch of stuff.
Working on, still trying to, you know, my family's been dead on my case to finish my own CD of some of those tunes that you played earlier. And that's a major initiative for me this year. I've got the tracks, trying to get to that final mix, and I've been, if I had to do a song for you, Chocolate, I could do it, produce it, mix it, put it out there, and it'd be great. But in trying to figure it out for myself, I'm stuck in that little spot. I keep hearing things that I didn't think I could fix. I can make it better. I can play it better. I can do it just a little bit better. So,
and I totally understand that.
You know, so I'm trying to get I'm trying to get it out of my hands. Actually, that's, you know, trying to find some producers and some people who could do a mix and mix for me and just take it out of my hands. And that's where I'm at now. I got the songs, just a mix away.
Okay. Well, just remember, if you ever need any funk, you know where to come. Just always remember that.
Absolutely.
Now, let me ask you this: for up and coming artists, I always like to ask my guests. Because my guests are always pioneers, legends, you know what I'm saying, OGs. So I always like to ask them what advice they would give those who are serious about doing music in these days and times.
I think, you know, it's rough in as much as that, you know, the electronic generation is out there. I mean, you have some situations now, and I'm sure you're aware, There's DJs that are that can get paid more for a show than a live band can get paid for the same show. So live music is, you know, it's got its dukes up right now, you know, but it's coming back, and there's a resurgence on all levels, because it's got to be there, and we got to keep it alive. So my advice to anybody young trying to come up would be, don't give up. The struggle is hard. It's going to seem bleak at times, but on the B side, the rewards are immeasurable. You know, there's nothing better than playing in a tight ass band on stage in front of millions, you know, or the reverse, you know, playing with a tight ass band in a club with five people in it, and we're just having fun and we're doing our thing. I just love to play. And so if they can just hone your craft, stay true to what you believe in, it'll be okay. It may take a minute to get there, but it'll be fine.
It'll be okay, just like that brother told you. Listen, go back, because you think you're playing, but you really aren't, and you need to come back, get your act together, and come back. And so that's what you did. It took you a year, but you came on back and represented. So, you know, that's what you have to do. Things don't come when you're serious about what you're doing. Things don't come easy. Things don't come quick. You have to study. You know, you can have a guy, you know, musicians, talented people, creative people, you know, they're all, you know, they're gifts from God. So you can be gifted, but you can always make that gift be the best that you can possibly make it be. And that takes work. You know, it's not easy. It's not quick. It's not fast. It takes work. So now, for information about what you're doing, where you're going, where you're going to be, your itinerary and stuff, where do we go to find out about what Wayne Cobham is doing?
Well, I'm not great at that. I do have a website, but I haven't kept it up because just the time element. I don't have anybody managing for me. But I'll keep my Facebook thing live, and I'll keep that up to date. So on the social media areas right now, you can find out pretty much what I'm doing I've been staying on top of that a little bit more.
And I heard that. And you know what? But as long as you're doing Facebook, that's pretty much, you pretty much kind of on top of it, because I contacted you through Facebook. So as long as if you don't do anything else, keep that Facebook happening. Say hi to people on Facebook every once in a while. And, you know, that would be just about all you might need to do. Now, do you have any shout-outs?
Wait, though. You know, I am coming your way. I'll be out in July. I'll be coming and be working with a cabaret singer named Bonnie Scher, who's a native of L.A., and we'll be doing something at the Catalina Club, and that should be sort of fun. So I'll be in the neighborhood.
Do you know around when in July you're coming?
That's the, on the 18th.
On the 18th, so that's soon.
That's soon. We're coming.
All right. So that means that I'll be seeing you soon.
I hope so.
Okay. So now, huh?
I want to know more about the Funk Box.
Oh, I'll tell you anything you need. Well, shoot, all that stuff you just got through running down to me. The Funk Box is the Rhythm King. That's what the Funk Box is, the Rhythm King, okay? And I was playing the button. Because,
it was great.
You know,
It was great. It was great.
Yeah, because, you know, I wanted to have something to do. I just didn't want to stand up there and be the chick singer and, you know, play the tambourine every once in a while. I wanted to be a part of the fabric of the funk. And so I wanted to feel included in every way. So it's like, Larry, we have to find me something to play. And so that's what he came up with. And like you say, the rest is history. So I would like to say that for all things chocolate, you can go to my website, patricechocolatebanks.com. I want to thank my family tonight. I want to thank all the Funkalutionaries. I want to thank the Facebook Nation, Team Chocolate, Beverly Black Johnson, the creator of Tribe Family Channel. And I just want to thank you so much, Wang, for joining us tonight, because you are really, when I say you're a busy person, you are a busy person. And the mission that you are on though, there is no greater mission, because you are definitely keeping the music alive, not just the funk alive, but the music alive, period. And so honored to have you as a guest tonight. And I want to tell all my listeners, until next week, God bless your hearts real good, and may the funk be with all of you. And I didn't get to all of your songs during the show, Wang, but we're going to play them on the outro. We're going to play every single one of them. So for anybody that wants to stay and party with us as we go out until Blog Talk shuts us down, we're going to be partying with more of Wang Cobham's music and more of Michael and Wicked Wilson Pickett. We're going to be doing all of that. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. It's been great. Fun to meet you. And I always wanted to do that, and I'm glad we had a chance to share a moment.
The pleasure has been all mine. But I'm going to talk to you in a couple of weeks. Okay?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
And here we go. May the funk be with you, Wayne.
You too, doll.
All right.
Bye-bye.
I'm bored. I want to be entertained. Can my pharaoh find some way to entertain his queen?
And what is it you're going to do?
Thank you. Thank you. Oh, baby, the dust.